Welcome, listeners, to the 58th episode of Beyond Your Newsfeed, Understanding Contemporary Politics, a podcast of the Providence College Political Science Department. My name is William Hudson, Professor Emeritus of Political Science, and host of this podcast. Although most of us associate the People's Republic of China, or the PRC, with its officially sanctioned atheism, the government tolerates a variety of religious practice within the country, regulating and controlling religious practice to assure that it does not pose a threat to the dominance of either the Chinese state or the ruling Chinese Communist Party, is an ongoing challenge to both party and state. Professor Susan McCarthy, the Providence College Political Science Department's China expert and a leading authority on ethnic and religious minorities in China, has returned to Beyond Your Newsfeed to discuss recent developments in PRC's efforts to regulate religious practice. Our discussion centers on two of Dr. McCarthy's recent papers on this topic. The first, Liberating Party Animals, Cultural Governance and Life Release Rituals in China, which was published in July 2022 in the China Journal, the leading journal in Chinese politics, by the way. And an as-yet-unpublished paper, Sinicizing China's Muslim World City, World Muslim City, Spatial Politics, National Narratives, and Ethno-Religious Assimilation in the PRC. Professor Susan McCarthy, welcome back to Beyond Your Newsfeed.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
To begin, Susan, we perhaps need to go over some background of what's been going on to China and put these developments in the sphere of regulating religion in context. First, there has been a recent trend over the last decade or so to increase Communist Party control over Chinese society. Correct? How has that worked?
Yes, that is correct. So one of the things that we saw happening, certainly through much of the reform era, certainly the 1990s and the 2000s, is there was a diversification in society, in economics, and in all sorts of cultural activities, and all sorts of new organizations and activities and interests that people had over which the party had little control, including private enterprise, including the state itself, that is, government agencies. When Xi Jinping came to power, he was selected as general secretary of the CCP in late 2012. He really inaugurated this period of trying to tighten party, that is CCP, control over society, but over the state itself, that is making government bureaucrats as well as lower level party officials more answerable to the top leadership, and to counter a lot of fragmentation in the political system that often frustrated Beijing's efforts to call the shots. And we've seen this tightening up in a whole range of activities and organizations, and it has definitely affected religion as well.
Yeah, I would think in that era of loosening in the 1990s and early 2000s, religious organizations had more flexibility as well, right?
Yes. In fact, these two essays, an article and hopefully soon to be published article, these actually grow out of earlier work that I published on religious charity. In the 2000s, I became really interested in the rise of religious charity. I was sort of astounded, given the atheism that you mentioned, that the Chinese government even allowed religious groups to engage in various social endeavors outside of registered religious sites. That seemed to be almost encouraging religious groups to take a larger role in society and social endeavors, and in so doing, legitimizing religion. So anyway, I became very interested in this. I had a sabbatical in 2007, 2008, did some research on Muslim, Buddhist, and Chinese Catholic charities. It was very fascinating. When I went back in 2014, they're still active, but there was definitely a chilling of the kinds of things that they could do a chilling that wasn't solely related to the crackdown of on religion, but was partly due to that crackdown.
And it was associated with this broader cut down attempt to control various societal and state organizations and bring them in line and control of the party.
Yeah. In fact, one thing that seemed to really curtail or worry the charities I talked to was the anti-corruption campaign initiated by Xi Jinping, which has basically gone after party officials, party and state officials, and has been in place essentially for over a decade now. And that seemed to curtail a lot of more lavish banquets and spending that charitable groups often use to raise money. So even that campaign has had some interesting, you know, side effects on religious endeavors.
And corruption is a very vague and potentially broad category as well, right?
Yes, yes.
And so the party could, Xi could very kind of selectively pick people he wanted to push out of the way. And sort of this tightening from the center by the party has gone along with an increasing power of Xi himself, right?
Yes, yes. Xi Jinping has really acquired extensive power. He's often referred to, and I'm sure listeners may have heard this, but he's often referred to as the most powerful leader since Mao Zedong. In 2017, he and his supporters managed to get through a revision to the Chinese constitution that has allowed him to serve an unprecedented third term, and it's certainly expected that he'll serve a fourth 5-year term. So for the foreseeable future, there is no one in the waiting in the wings. There's no threat to his authority, and he's expected to hold on to authority.
And accompanying this is he's kind of brought back the old cult of personality, right? That it's at some point was condemned in China, right?
Yes. Yeah. You know, it's not quite the same as the Maoist cult of personality. It seems to be lacking the genuine charisma that Mao had, but it certainly seems to emulate features of that cult of personality. So with regard to religion, for instance, Sinicization, one of the elements is religious groups are expected to, you know, incorporate study of Xi Jinping into some of their activities and even put his picture up in religious organizations and make sure that the party and Xi himself are prominent features.
Whoa, that brings to my mind a very strange image. Next to the crucifix in a Catholic church is a picture of Xi Jinping.
Maybe not right next to the crucifix, but it might be when you go in the building.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah. Okay, in the entryway.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. So for a little more background, we very often don't associate China with a lot of ethnic and religious diversity. We think of China as, I guess, maybe as the in terms of the predominant Han culture, right? But in fact, as your work has shown over the years, there is quite a bit of diversity ethnically and religiously in China.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at the percentages, it's quite small. So only about, you know, somewhere between 8 and 9% of the population is ethnic minority. But 8 or 9% of the population is a huge population, well over 100 million people. So again,
yeah, we're talking about China.
Yes. And the population. Han, yeah, and the Han are very diverse themselves too. But China does have a quite cohesive culture. I do want to stress that. But yet there is considerable diversity.
Okay. Well, could we say a little bit more about the Communist Party's policies towards religion? What has, I mean, going back to say beginning the post-Mao period, what has been the overall attitude towards religious practice in China?
Very important question. So just for background, during the Maoist period, that is 1949 up until Mao died in 1976, for much of that period, religion was largely suppressed. And this reflected the ideological goals of the Communist Party and the Marxist view of religion as futile and as something that, you know, a communist society should you know, we should not see in a genuinely socialist society.
The opiate of the people.
Exactly. So once Deng Xiaoping came to power and the party was trying to sort of rebuild after the disaster of the Maoist era, the party recognized that they had to move away from some of these really repressive policies and rebuild support among people. And so the decision, basically an announcement was made that a new, a quote unquote, new era was afoot with regard to religion, and the decision was made to allow religious groups to kind of reconstitute their organizations, but within limits. So in China, five religions are recognized, and religious organizations have to be affiliated with these, and those are supervised by the Religious Affairs Bureau. And the five religions are Chinese Catholicism, Christianity, which is basically Protestantism, Buddhism, Islam, and Taoism. So in theory, you know, the Chinese constitution says that Chinese people have religious freedom, but this is very much within limits and it's very much supervised, and that supervision by the Religious Affairs Bureau involves things like political study, whereby priests or imams or monks and whomever have to periodically go through training in religious policy. And in many ways, like in much of the country, people are pretty free to conduct religious activities within the confines of religious sites. But increasingly, those are supervised and hassled in many ways by the regime.
Okay, so since, say, the 1990s, religious practitioners have to be a little more careful. They have to worry that maybe their activities, I suppose, are being monitored more closely by the state. And
I would say they've always had to be concerned about that. Yeah. So I mentioned, for instance, in that I was studying religious charity and I did this project and did research in 2008. And I had an interesting conversation with a nun because I was asking about the religious content of some of their charitable programming. And I asked her, you know, where's the line? And she pointed out that as so long as she was holding events on within the confines of the church grounds, it wasn't really an issue. But if she were to go out on the street and start talking about Jesus or something, they would be immediately shut down. So there has always been this concern for spatial boundaries and enclosure of certain activities within these highly regulated, observed sites.
It's like the attitude of the state is, we'll allow you to practice your religion, but no proselytizing, no evangelizing.
Correct, which is why I was interested in charity, because charity, of course, brings religion into, you know, disaster areas or schools or the public sphere. And I was really interested in this as a kind of way of what I call repurposing secular spaces to pursue religious ends.
Yeah. And I would think the state would be concerned about that outreach because people receiving charity might suddenly get interested in the religious belief of the people who's providing it, right?
Yeah. This is actually the subject of a 2013 article that I published.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, let's turn to this first paper that you published in 2022, which is very interesting, which I think gets at this sort of delicate dance that the party does around and the state does around, you know, religious ritual. And so you talked about this practice of Fang Sheng. Did I pronounce that right?
Fang Sheng,
which involves, which is at in Bass, a Taoist practice originally, or a Buddhist kind of practice that involves people gaining merit by freeing animals in distress.
Yeah, I guess it's really more of a Buddhist slash folk religious practice. It's common in other Buddhist societies as well, and Buddhists in the United States sometimes engage in Fang Sheng.
Okay, so tell us the story there. How has the state and party responded to this practice? And you might want to say a little bit more about what that means.
Sure. So Fang Sheng or life release. Basically, it means to, well, release life. So if somebody comes upon, an animal in distress, you know, a wolf or, you know, or maybe a dog with its foot caught in something and you release it and you set it free. Buddhists believe that you can gain merit. And merit is something that facilitates salvation. So a certain subs, you know, subsets of Buddhism have notions of salvation that are kind of analogous with Christianity. But the idea is if you do things that assist life and that rescue creatures from suffering, you can gain merit. And merit is something you could kind of build up almost like money in a bank, and you can transfer it to your ancestors or your family members. Basically, it's doing good deeds to alleviate suffering, and you know, because you want to become more like a Buddha, more compassionate, and you want to build up merit. But what's happened in China is that this has become really, really popular. And so what Buddhist groups do, lay groups, temple organizations, is they go and they'll say, go to the market and buy up all these fish and then release them in the river. They'll literally rescue the fish from being sold for dinner. In fact, some translations of life release refer to it as life rescue. So as people have become more affluent in the PRC, they've started, you know, doing more and more life rescue. And you know, again, lots of groups have popped up where people, again, purchase birds and fish and even poisonous snakes and then release them, quote unquote, into the wild in order to gain merit. The problem is often these releases have very negative environmental effects. So people will be releasing non-native species into very delicate ecosystems. There's a case I talk about in the article where this group of people went to a kind of, you know, slightly illegal farm and bought up several hundred foxes and raccoon dogs, which are related to foxes. And then they released them in this forested area in the outskirts of Beijing. And I mean, the animals were born and raised on a farm. They were not bred to survive in the wild. They killed all the chickens in the village. And a lot of them ended up turning up dead. But basically, this caused a big problem for the villagers living in the area. And eventually, they did find the perpetrators and find them. But this was really a big mess, and it wasn't very well thought out. So these kinds of fangsheng accidents, as I call them, happen, you know, with some regularity in the PRC. So this is the kind of thing that the government wants to control. It's tried to outlaw certain practices, but there's a recognition that they can't control all these life release practices. So they've tried to standardize it. And one way they've done so is by creating these official fangsheng organizations that they hope that are supposed to organize fangsheng activities and show people the right way to do it and carry it out in, you know, mindful of the ecology of the waterways or fields or whatnot in which they're releasing these animals.
Yeah, in your paper, you describe these organizations as government-organized NGOs.
Yes. Yeah.
Gongos.
Yes.
I thought that was interesting.
It's a very common phenomenon in China.
Right. Yeah. So that's interesting. So here the government is faced with this increasingly popular practice that has its roots in religion, though you're suggesting that many of the people who engage in it aren't really doing it for religious reasons. It's more of a cultural practice, kind of?
Well, no, I would say it's religious now, but with the Fangsheng associations, it's a little dicey. They're trying to govern religious practice by holding these Fangsheng activities, but they're trying to, I mean, the idea is that they can hopefully convince everyday ordinary Fangsheng practitioners to show up at their own events and, you know, release fish or release birds or whatever under the supervision of these gongos, so that they won't be doing this on a regular basis in ecologically unsound ways. It hasn't worked, but the idea, they're essentially using these as educational organizations to manage and guide practitioners' behavior.
And so how do these organizations manage the religious symbolism that might be associated with this practice?
So they will have monks come and lead, you know, these life release events and say prayers. I mean, these present themselves as NGOs, even though they're often staffed by people who have government and even party connections. There aren't many of these. This isn't super widespread, but they're much more common like in Southeast China.
Why is the state not more worried about this? I mean, that wouldn't they, again, this is more of a public practicing of religious ritual. Wouldn't that set off alarm bells in the Communist Party? And
well, it might, you would think. Again, I do think that this reflects you know, the tolerance of certain cultural practices. And because Fangsheng is associated with Buddhism and Taoism, quote unquote, Chinese religions, Han Chinese religions, they're less, you know, it's less sensitive. And because they can be kind of presented as a cultural endeavor. And that's how many people sort of defend their activities. Like, we're just engaging in traditional Chinese culture. And one of Xi Jinping's big things is to rejuvenate traditional Chinese culture.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I was just going to say, he has been promoting traditional Chinese culture, so this could be connected.
Absolutely.
This is okay. This is in aligns with the Communist Party's program, because we're just enhancing Chinese culture, and the religious part will just kind of ignore.
Right. And I mean, one of the things I talk about in that article that I find really fascinating is how the Communist Party has tried to incorporate life release into its own endeavors. So as part of Xi Jinping, not, and this happened before Xi Jinping, but as part of the CCP's efforts to kind of reestablish its authority over state and society, it's beefed up local party organizations, party branches, party committees, in neighborhoods and corporations and whatnot. And party branches are expected to hold what are, you know, monthly themed party days, where all the members, like 50 members of a party branch within a, you know, university or something, get together and they have some activity. And they study Xi Jinping thought, and they go to some famous monument, and they reflect on the glorious history of the CCP. Well, what some of these groups are doing is they're visiting, state-run or affiliated hatcheries and fisheries, and learning about ecological restoration practices. And then they actually carry out life release. They don't call it life release. It's proliferation and release, basically restocking of waterways. But they're releasing, you know, hatchlings usually that are of the right species for a given lake or river. And then they go and they have a kind of quasi-religious experience where they retake the party oath. And, you know, so there's this interesting kind of almost sanctification, it's kind of dual secularization and sanctification of this activity in an effort to kind of incorporate it into the ritual practices of the Communist Party and sort of build esprit de corps and build dedication to Xi and the party mission.
Right. So it's become kind of a party ritual then. It's
yes.
Like,
yeah.
Well, that's very interesting. And this practice has not been curtailed to any degree, but with this sort of crackdown on society, or
not that I know of, not that I know of.
Yeah. So this practice can sort of coexist along with the emphasis on increasing power of the Communist Party, and partly because of this sort of cultural link.
Yeah, and there is this effort to kind of try and convince people to think about life release in a different way and to think about the environmental implications.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sort of basically to use it as an educational tool or propaganda tool to spread the party's environmental message. And one way we see this is in the creation of this new kind of annual holiday called National Fish Release Day, which happens every June 6th.
Wow.
And so this is only a few years old, but basically all over the country, there'll be these simultaneous release activities, again, overseen by the, you know, the, I forget what bureau, but it's like the Bureau of Fisheries, and the fish or the hatchlings are all provided by, you know, state regulated, state approved hatcheries. So they're healthy. They're not, exotic species or anything. And there is, you know, I write about the kind of authoritarian effervescence of these events that I draw on, you know, the work of Durkheim and his notion of collective effervescence, the sort of that feeling of kind of self-transcendence and excitement that occurs in group activities that sort of brings people out of themselves and kind of intensifies dedication to the collective. And
might make people love the party.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. So I think that the effervescence of life release activities, which are fun and exciting and different and lots of right. people participate, you know, that's the hope anyway.
Right. Yeah, Big Brother most of all wanted love. Right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, the party definitely wants people to support. It doesn't it doesn't just suppress and coerce. It wants the people to love it.
Yeah. Great. So let's move on to your next paper, which is a very kind of a different case where an institution has been more seriously affected by the crackdown by the party on religious practice, and that's this effort to create a world Muslim city. You want to give us the background on that?
Yeah. So, well, I'll start by just noting that the paper started as a paper I was trying to write about development narratives and the way in which different official narratives are mobilized by local and regional actors to support various pet projects, including, you know, regional development projects. And I was interested in this particular endeavor, World Muslim City, which in many ways was a big kind of real estate property development boondoggle. But anyway, so there, this World Muslim City was planned for a province, actually technically considered an autonomous region, the Ningxia Hui Autonomous Region. The Hui are Muslims. They're one of they're actually the largest of the 10 Muslim minorities in the PRC. But they're often considered the most assimilated Muslim group, and they're found all over China. But World Muslim City was also this effort by officials, government officials in Ningxia, to grow the economy and to really build up linkages between Ningxia and the Arab and Muslim world, to kind of turn this very backward, remote province into a so-called bridgehead for international exchange and trade with the Muslim / Arab world. So World Muslim City, again, it was this idea that we're going to, you know, basically build, you know, resorts and art exhibition spaces and museums and fancy new mosques and things to basically
shopping malls.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, event sites, whatever, to basically, you know, convince people in the Arab world to maybe invest in Ningxia and maybe even buy summer homes there. And this was connected to an effort to just, you know, enhance China Mideast trade. Ningxia, the capital of Ningxia, the city of Incheon, was made the permanent site of something called the China Arab Expo, which is a trade fair that happens every few years in China. And so World Muslim City was sort of piggybacking on the China Arab Expo and this broader effort to promote China Arab trade.
And this would be also connected to the Belt and Road Initiative, right? This effort by China to connect itself with economically and politically around the world.
Yeah, so World Muslim City, the ideas for it actually predate the Belt and Road. But once the Belt and Road was announced, this seemed like a great way to kind of glom onto it and take advantage of this now national policy, something that seemed to really converge with what World Muslim City was about.
Yeah, so one would think, I mean, this was around 2010 or so, this was all happening, right? I mean,
Yes, but Belt and Road didn't really get going until 2013, 2014. But there were already some similar right. policies in place, the Silk Road Economic Belt. And, you know, so this some of Xi Jinping's slogans and like actually are borrowings from things that were happening or in the 2000s.
Right. But overall, World Muslim City was part of what seemed like a broader Chinese initiative to connect itself economically to part of globalization. And one would think it would be something that the state and the party both would be very happy about.
Yeah, and they were. So one thing to realize is that the Chinese government and Arab countries, especially the more affluent or more affluent Muslim countries, I should say in general, have often used sort of Muslim philanthropy as a kind of way to kind of build these informal connections. And Ningxia itself, because it has a large Hui population, has often been the kind of site of many of these, of this kind of diplomatic philanthropy or philanthropic diplomacy. That is, what I mean by that is like international Muslim aid organizations will carry out aid projects in Ningxia, which historically has been very poor. And this is a way of, again, building relationships with the party state and, you know, building, you know, for trade and energy and cloud computing, whatever the industrial interest of the day is. So the party state was, you know, behind this effort to essentially mobilize Muslim identity and Muslim religious culture and practice for purposes of trade and diplomacy. And the party state in Ningxia certainly was behind this and was very much involved in getting World Muslim City off the ground. But the state council, that is the China's equivalent to a cabinet in Beijing, had sent essentially a bunch of representatives of different agencies to Ningxia in, I think it was 2008. And they formulated a plan for Ningxia's development and said, we need to mobilize Muslim, Hui Muslim identity and culture and use this as a resource that can bring in more investment, more trade, and really enhance our relations. So this was something that was very much supported by the government.
So the local party and the central party said, this is a good thing, we should do it.
Absolutely.
So what went wrong? What happened?
So one of the things I was doing in this paper was thinking about, like, you know, exactly what caused the demise of World Muslim City. And kind of as an overall strategy, we definitely need to see rising Islamophobia in China, Xi Jinping's crackdown on religion in general and Islam in particular, and the curtailing of sort of Muslim expressions of cultural identity as a big part of the story. However, the more I dug into it, the more I realized that a lot of what went wrong was sort of bad planning, maybe some corruption, certainly shady land deals.
Yeah, and the usual real estate, exactly, the nonsense, right?
Exactly.
That big development.
This
projects.
Wasn't just a story of Islamophobia.
The big dig.
Yeah. It's sort of so. It, you know, this, a lot of the World Muslim City sites or the specific projects were planned for rural areas, and the whole issue of land ownership in China is still very fraught. And so you have to go through all, you can't just freely buy and sell land. And if you want to convert agricultural land for industrial purposes, that has to be approved. If you want to transfer land from rural collectives, villages, to, say, developers, that has to be approved. And so some of these projects, they were implemented before the approvals were even acquired. Par for the course in China throughout the 2000s. So this wasn't unusual in that regard. But, you know, you start to see a clampdown on this sort of activity. The project actually ran out of financing. That was part of the issue. They overplanned and didn't really get the financing all lined up. And so that's one reason why it floundered. Then the project was bought by this national conglomerate, which really then promised great things. So the budget went from like 800 million to, what is it, 2.3 billion or something like that. You know, ridiculous figures, essentially. And it just couldn't carry it out. So a lot of this, again, was your classic real estate boondoggle, poor planning, misjudgment about, you know, how quickly they could get approvals, and overpromising by, you know, in some cases by entrepreneurs who didn't know what they were doing. But I would say that as a whole, World Muslim City and various installations were suspended and shut down because of Islamophobia. And so one example of this, we see this with the Sino-Arab Axis. And this was a successful project. And the Sino-Arab Axis is basically a big boulevard with park and parkland and walking trails or walking sidewalks and the like, and all these gardens and sculptures. And it's in the city of Yinchuan. And it was built to celebrate Sino-Arab trade and parts of the Sino-Arab axis, really kind of celebrated Chinese traditional culture. Other parts of the axis celebrated, you know, Arab culture. It had, you know, various pavilions and sculptures and the like that were Islamic or Arabic in nature. Well, basically, in beginning around 2018, the city government completely revamped it and renamed it. They renamed it Unity Road, and they revised the pseudo-Arab sculptures and installations to make them look Chinese.
Right. You have a photo in your article of a domed Arab-looking building or Muslim-looking building that's changed into, looks like a Chinese pagoda.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, anything arched is bad. It's got to be anything concave is bad. It's got to be convex, essentially. Right. So it has to be sloped. So the change is, in some ways, it's really superficial, but it's dramatic at the same time and signals that the notion of what counts as Chinese culture and Chinese tradition is going to be very limited, and that public spaces have to reflect this. So this is why I say, even though many aspects of World Muslim City failed for kind of, you know, reasons of bad financing and then poor planning and the like, or even corruption, as an overall project, World Muslim City, you know, was doomed once she started calling for the sinicization of Islam. And we've seen this throughout China, where mosques that have domed roofs or built in kind of the Central Asian or Arab style are now being torn down or partly rebuilt to reflect quote unquote Chinese characteristics.
Yeah, and sinicization is a project that goes beyond this Islamic project, right?
Yes. So all religions are expected to sinicize, including Taoism, which is indigenous to China. So I don't quite know what that means.
And that's probably affected the Catholic Church in China as well, right?
Yeah. So the earliest kind of proto-sinicization occurred in, say, 2016 in the province of Zhejiang in eastern China. And there was a big campaign to remove crosses from the tops of church buildings. And I should say that these crosses were often gigantic. They're enormous. They're bright red at night, lit. And in parts of Zhejiang, they're very, very obvious because you have, you know, some sizable Christian communities there. And so there was this big effort to just lop off these giant crosses. Again, in many cases, the churches remained, not always. Sometimes churches were blown up. But in many cases, they were allowed to remain and operate, but they couldn't have these really overt symbols of their religiosity be seen to be intruding on the public realm. And so, you know, even with sinicization, sometimes domes of mosques are removed, but the mosque is still functioning. Yes, that you have other intrusions, you know, required attendance at flag raising ceremonies and Xi Jinping study events. So it's not quite that Islam or Catholicism or Christianity is being suppressed, but it is being curtailed and required to, you know, religious people are required to, in a sense, perform their loyalty to the Communist Party. And I do want to say that what I'm talking about does not apply to Xinjiang. Xinjiang, where the Uyghurs live, is a very different case. There we've had serious suppression of Islam.
Right. Yeah, the Uyghurs, that's a Muslim group that's been basically, it's almost genocide there. Cultural destruction.
Yeah. And, you know, well over a million people have been detained, and those who haven't been detained are under surveillance. And
right.
Yeah, it's very, really great.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you about that. How about the way people living in Ningzhou, are their lives been affected by this at all? The sinicization?
Yes. Well, sinicization. So,
I mean, you describe the way people as more in conformity to the dominant culture, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But have they found their lives changed at all by any
absolutely?
This?
So sinicization. You know, it was announced and then explored a bit, and then essentially like gradually started being introduced in 2016, and then really ramped up in 2018 in Ningxia. And so one thing we've seen throughout the province, or the autonomous region is, you know, there has been a closing of many mosques, closing and consolidation of mosques. Mosques have been torn down. Some of them have been, you know, there's very dramatic imagery of mosques that have had their domed roofs removed, as I said, and their, you know, convex roofs put back in their place. You know, so one thing this really does to people, I think, is it really makes apparent the power of the party state. And so even if they're still allowed to go to the mosque and pray, it puts them on notice that they are under watch and that the party has the ability to shut them down at, you know, at any moment. So in this way, it has affected people. But there's, in theory, as far as I know, in theory, they're still allowed to practice Islam, but their ability to sort of do so openly and freely and wear headscarves and even to fast sometimes or grow beards is really, you know, in jeopardy.
And the sinicization campaign has been more harsh against against Muslims than other religions?
That is my impression. That is my impression. And again, leaving aside the Uyghurs.
Yeah, and why is that? Why would Xi be so concerned about Islam in particular?
Well, so to some extent, this is, if we have to situate this within the context of the Great War on Terror, that it reflects sort of, I think, general trends. We see this in India as well, a real hostility by the dominant culture towards Islam. I should note that in 2008 and 2009, there were deadly ethnic riots in Tibet between, you know, Tibetan Buddhists and people living in Lhasa, Tibetans and non-Tibetans living in Lhasa. And then 2009 were ethnic riots in the Urumqi, the capital of Xinjiang, that were expressions of frustration and anger against Han oppression of Uyghurs, but left many Han people in Urumqi dead. Then in 2014, there was this attack in the main train station of the city of Kunming in southwest China, where a group of six Uyghur assailants stabbed and killed like 26 or so people and injured dozens more. Really a shocking, brutal attack, you know, 1,000 kilometers from Xinjiang. So it sort of made many Chinese people aware that this could come to their backyard or this could come to their city. And that really sparked, really kind of fueled the rise of Islamophobia, which had always been there. Mm-hmm. The dominant culture has always been suspicious of Islam in many ways. And even though Muslims have been in China for, you know, 1,000 years, Islam is still viewed as a quote unquote foreign religion. Same with Christianity has been in China for, you know, 400 years or so. And it too is still deemed quote unquote foreign. But this is why, you know, I think this explains a lot of the hostility by many Han people and that you see on social media to Islam and explains why, you know, Muslims have really been treated quite poorly in recent years.
And what impact has all this had with China's relationship with Arab countries?
Not impacted it at all.
Aha. Uh-huh. So geopolitics rules, right?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, you know, it's disheartening that other more Muslim countries have sometimes, they've gone on study trips to Xinjiang and praised the government's, you know, rehabilitation efforts of Uyghurs. And yeah, it's very disheartening.
Right. Actually, that sounds kind of familiar. It's like Donald Trump and all his anti-Muslim rhetoric, but also cozying up with Saudi Arabia.
Oh, yeah.
At the same time. So
very similar.
So these things are divided and separated. There's similarity in politics everywhere, right?
Yes.
So what are the sort of future implications of all of this? I mean, is this just part of an increasing centralization of power in China? Are we going to see less diversity, an impact on any kind of deviation from the dominant culture in the future? Is this what's going to happen?
That's a great question. So I think as long as she is in power, there are going to be these serious restrictions in place, even after he passes from the scene, whenever that is. I guess, you know, I don't think it's going to eliminate ethno-religious diversity. And you know, one thing I've studied is the resilience of religious and ethnic groups to find ways to express their culture, their beliefs, their traditions in all sorts of innovative ways, you know, oftentimes making use of the institutions and spaces and practices that the party state itself creates as vehicles for their expression or for their communities. So I'm not worried that these peoples and groups will survive, except maybe the Uyghurs. I am worried about them. You know, one thing we have seen in the past in China is something that's been called the Fangshou cycle, a cycle of grasping tight and letting go. And we've been going through a period in which the party has grasped ever more tightly. You know, it's not a predictable cycle, but I expect in the future, I hope in the future, there'll be some kind of loosening and that we'll get something. Well, I don't know what normal is in the PRC, but something that leaves a little bit more space for religious expression and ethnic diversity.
Yeah, and these cycles can be influenced by sort of larger developments. I know China's really facing some serious problems, demographic, economic challenges. Certainly the initial loosening back in the 80s and 90s was a response to a desire by the party leadership to address, you know, the economic and social issues in China. So maybe those things could lead to a letting go in the future.
Yeah, and I think the really relevant point with all that is that letting go occurred after a leadership transition. So we may not see real loosening or, you know, change in policy until there is some kind of leadership transition. But for the time being, none is in the works.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Well, this has been an interesting conversation, Susan. Once again, it's great to have you on Beyond Your Newsfeed. I think this is your third appearance. That's your third appearance, I think.
Yes.
I went back and looked at the records. And it's always enlightening to learn about China, which is a very interesting place. And we're very fortunate at Providence College to have you on the faculty and can keep us up to date on what's happening there. So thanks very much for joining us today, Susan, and all of your insights.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. And thanks especially to our Beyond Your News feed producer, Gabriel Capello Rios, who does a marvelous job making us sound good over the airwaves. Thank you, Gabriel. And thank also to Joe Carr and Chris Judge of PC's Division of Marketing and Communications. And finally, thank you to our listeners. Please like us on social media and review us on Apple Podcasts. And please tell four friends about us.